The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Christmas greetings to you. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. And underwriting our program for over 10 years, thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we are going to return on Christmas Eve is the date of the first broadcast of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina, the December 2019 edition. We have five Tuesdays this month, so we'll have one more reading on Christmas Eve. I am not here in person, but I am recording this in advance, as usual. But if you celebrate the holiday, a very happy Merry Christmas to you. We're going to read two articles from this issue. The first one is about Manteo, and I believe the second one is about Thomasville. A Gift from Above. During the Berlin blockade in 1948, a young pilot launched a mission to drop parachutes of candy to the hungry children of the city. Each December, the same pilot takes the skies over Manteo to show that one generous gesture is as powerful as ever. Written by Robert H. Smith. This picture of the front end of the plane here, and a picture, perhaps simulated a little bit for the camera, but of a child reaching up and receiving what looks to be like an iPhone coming down in a little parachute. Hundreds of children stream across the field next to Deer County Regional Airport, tripping over the stiff December grass, heads tipping skyward as the Spirit of Freedom, a refurbished World War II-era Douglas C-54 Skymaster, approaches from the east. The whap, whap, whap of its hefty propellers thumps in their chests. Those with experience at Manteo's annual candy drop race ahead to the spot where the last year's flurry of chocolate and bubblegum landed. As the plane finally roars overhead, low enough to see the flight crew grinning from the windows, it releases 700 tiny white parachutes, bits of fabric tied with string, each holding a single piece of candy. A cheer erupts. The scramble is on. Parents clustered around the field appear just as delighted as their kids. Who knew that? More than a century after the first flight at Kitty Hawk, an old rumbling plane could make so many feel joy, even wonder. Standing off to the side, 78-year-old Karen Edmond wears a smile more knowing than most. Edmond grew up in Berlin during World War II, a little girl who wore the same polka dot dress every day for 2 years and went to sleep every night unsure who or what to fear most, Hitler or the Allied bombs meant to stop him. "I wanted to forget my childhood," she says, her German accent still apparent. "We didn't grow up as normal 5 or 6 year olds. Years later, Edmond married a U.S. serviceman, moved to the United States, and had 5 children of her own. But, she says, "I never told anything about the war years to my children." By 1999, she was divorced and living on Roanoke Island, where she worked as a cook. That Christmas, Edmond's daughter heard about a candy drop featuring a World War II transport plane at the Deer County Airport. She took her mother to see it, and Edmond recognized the C-54 before she even saw it. "I heard the engine roaring and thought, oh my God, I'm going back in time," she said. Nearly 20 years later, Edmond stands in the same field at the Manteo Airport, the thunder of the C-54 engines overhead, and one particular memory from her childhood comes back to her, a good one, a hopeful one, a memory worth saving. In the summer of 1948, Edmund was about to turn 7. The war was over, but Berlin was still in shambles. And for Edmund, there was a new fear. "We were always afraid the Russians were coming," she says. Germany had been divided into 4 military zones by the U.S., Britain, France, and Russia. The city of Berlin ended up in the Russian territory, but because of its importance, it too was divided equally into 4 zones. West Berlin became a powerful island of free enterprise in the middle of communist territory. But on June 24, 1948, Joseph Stalin blocked access to West Berlin. The 2 million people living there, including Edmund and her family, were trapped without enough food and critical supplies. The moment was known as the Berlin Blockade. "You're darn right we were hungry," Edmund recalls. "That's a pain you'll never forget." That summer, her mother put Edmund and her siblings to bed at 6 every night so that they wouldn't burn calories. To whispered requests for an extra slice of bread, she'd simply respond, "Children, what do you want to eat tomorrow?" As days passed and the summer heat rippled through the war-torn city, the Western powers agonized about how to help the stranded citizens now in their care. The Russians had blocked roads, canals, and railroads, but they'd overlooked the fine print of a binding post-war agreement that gave no country sole control of airspace. Gail Halvorsen, an Air Force transport pilot who had ferried cargo in the South Atlantic during the war, would become a key player in helping bust through the blockade. Halvorsen had grown up on a sugar beet farm in Utah where he fell in love with flying by watching biplanes buzz over his family's fields. He was just the kind of pilot needed for Operation Vittles, the West's audacious plan to airlift food and supplies through narrow airspace corridors under the nose of the Russian military into Tempelhof Airport in the heart of West Berlin. Planes took off and landed every 3 minutes. Supplies were quickly unloaded by grateful German citizens. There was an expression of humble gratitude, Halvorsen wrote years later, surprised by how easy it was to aid a former enemy. The look in their eyes was unmistakable. No matter what had gone on before, they were individuals, human beings. As a child, Edmund watched the life-saving planes from her apartment window. "Hearing the engines approach was music to our ears," she says. "We knew they were going to give us food. It was survival." Adventurous kids snuck down to the grassy field by the Tempelhof runway to watch through the barbed wire fence. One afternoon, Halvorsen spotted a group of them lingering there and passed 2 sticks of bubble mint gum through the fence. He watched in amazement as they carefully divided up the meager offering. Those who didn't get gum split the sugar-scented paper, which they pressed to their noses. The next day, just before landing at Tempelhof, Halvorsen chucked 3 small parachutes, cloth handkerchiefs tied to a single piece of chocolate, through the flare chute in the cockpit. He wasn't sure where they landed, but the next day he borrowed handkerchiefs from his friends and did it again. The German government thought the idea was marvelous, and Halvorsen's commanding officers let the candy drops continue. The children of Berlin flooded the U.S. base in Rhein-Main with thank you letters addressed to Uncle Wackelflug, Uncle Wiggly Wings, because Halvorsen would wiggle his wings on approach. Some returned handkerchiefs for reuse. Halvorsen and his fellow pilots even got away with dropping a few candy parachutes over East Berlin before the Russians complained. Meanwhile, donations poured in. Paris, bubblegum, Hershey bars. The Jewish vice president of Hewler's Candy Company set crates of sweets for the German children. Operation Little Vittles, as the candy drop was called, rained treats on Berlin until the blockade ended the following May. 7-year-old Edmund never caught a piece of candy from the planes, but that mattered less than the fact that others did. Each tiny white parachute represented hope, a reminder that the poor and the hungry were not forgotten. Every year since 1999, the Spirit of Freedom, a C-54 just like the one that Halvorsen flew, had swooped into Antio for the Christmastime candy bomber reenactment. Uncle Wiggly Wings makes an appearance, too. For years, Colonel Halverson, still spry at 99 years old, has traveled the country with the historic plane, now piloted by its owner, Tim Chopp. Edmund reached out to the colonel in 2003, inviting him to town for their event, which she now organizes. The first candy they exchanged, she gave to him. Since then, the two friends have reunited almost every Christmas. But this December, she stunned him with a surprise visitor during the welcome reception at the Dare County Community Center 2 days before the candy drop. As the band played holiday tunes, Edmund, known affectionately around town as the German Lady, greeted folks at the door and made sure there were enough folding chairs for the growing crowd. Halverson and the crew were cheered onto the stage and began taking questions. That's when Edmund called out, "Rudy, would you please come up?" Four rows back, a silver-haired gentleman stood up, tentatively gripping a handkerchief. "Rudy is one who got candy from you in Christmas time, 1948, Edmund announced. "I can't believe it," Halverson exclaimed, leaning forward to better hear the man who said he'd waited 70 years to thank him. "God bless you," Halverson said. "Were you from Berlin?" "Rudy Arndt," answered, his voice slightly shaky in front of the crowd. "I didn't live in Berlin. I was born in what is today Poland. Arndt was nearly 5 years old when his family fled their village in the night. Young Arndt bundled up on a sled. For several years, they traveled from town to town on foot, staying here and there, begging for food from farmers. In December 1948, when he was 8 years old, his family walked into East Berlin and holed up in a wrecked house. Local kids told them about the candy dropping from parachutes in West Berlin, so he and his siblings went looking. "We actually saw the planes and the thousands of little parachutes," he told the stunned audience in Mandio. "Some of the West German kids got hold of the candy, felt sorry for us, and threw it over." Moved by the acts of kindness he experienced as a boy, Arndt went on to study theology and now lives in Florida with his wife. They were visiting her family in Wan Chis in December 2017 when, to his utter surprise, someone told him that the candy bomber was in town. The next year, he came for a visit again, and a friend connected him with Edmund. The two met at the McDonald's in Manteo and shared stories in German for hours. At times, the memories rushed out faster than the words. At the airport, Arndt and Edmund stood side by side as Halverson and the crew took off on the C-54s. Arndt's great-grandniece and nephew and Edmund's grandchildren and great-grandchildren dashed onto the field. Two of Halverson's children, now grown, were there too. When the parachutes opened, some of them floated gracefully into outstretched hands. But a batch of them had tangled up as they exited the plane and fell to the ground, cardboard box and all. Kids scampered to the box and immediately began passing the candy around. One piece each. No arguing, only gratitude. Like magic, a simple gesture of generosity had multiplied into many once again. Well, of course, this will have occurred by the time you hear this. The Manteo Candy Drop is at the Dare County Regional Airport Museum at 410 Airport Road in Manteo, December 15th at 1 and again at 1:30. You are listening to our state magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. And if you have any comments on our program, please call the studios 919-832-5138. And now let's go to Thomasville, the Toymaker's Elves. A real-life Geppetto brings the wonder of festive shop windows back to life. Denise Barnes got teary the moment she laid eyes on the dusty old mechanical elves. The last time she'd seen them was a half century earlier, when the elves were cheerfully working in Santa's workshop in the windows of the Hudson Belk department store in downtown Thomasville. Barnes was a smitten little girl then, with her nose pressed up against the plate glass window. "That was always one of my favorite things about Christmas growing up here," she recalls. "It was a wonderful tradition for people to take their children to see these window displays. I wanted to go back every night as long as they were up." But time had not been kind to the Thomasville elves. Dingy from decades of neglect, their motors had rusted and their inner components reeked of dry rot. For nearly two decades, the elves had been boxed up, first in a hot, dry attic and later in a dank, musty maintenance building downtown. When a colleague from the Thomasville Beautification Committee, Carol Brown, took Barnes to see what had become of them, Barnes, ever hopeful, asked, "Do they work?" The two women plugged in the six aging elves and six other Christmas characters one at a time and waited. Barnes teared up again as she saw what Brown already knew. The elves couldn't be salvaged. Even the few that still worked seemed to groan as they slowly and painfully whirred to life. "We tried to find people to work on them," Brown explained to her, "but nobody will touch them. We don't even know where else to look." Barnes didn't know where to look either, and resigned herself to the elves' probable fate. Then one Sunday morning last January, she happened to catch a TV segment about a New York toy maker known as the Geppetto of Brooklyn. His workshop overflowed with mechanical Christmas toys, talking and singing dolls, wishing visitors a Merry Christmas, just like the ones from the old Belk windows. Within minutes, she texted the video to members of the beautification committee. "You're not going to believe this," she wrote. "You've got to watch this story." Christmas window displays, a staple of department store shopping for generations, still delight children and dazzle those who recall their splendor from long ago. The tradition has its deepest roots in New York City, where Macy's had been creating magical window displays since the mid-1870s. The tradition reached Thomasville around 1960, when Belk began decorating its windows for Christmas. The store changed its scenes from one year to the next, purchasing new characters and rotating them in and out. Folks came from miles around to see the elves, as well as Thomasville's other festive attractions. "This is a small town, but we celebrated Christmas in a huge way," Barnes says. "We had one of the biggest Christmas parades in the state. We had these window displays, and Santa Claus was upstairs at Belk. So people would come at night to see the elves and then go up and talk to Santa." Larry Darr, who worked for Belk in the 70s, remembers how popular the displays were because he was often called upon in the morning to wipe away the fingerprints from the previous night's visitors. "There were actually fingerprints and nose prints," Darr said, "and there were two rows of prints, a row down low where children were looking through the window and a row up higher where their parents were looking." Eventually, though, the mechanical characters begin falling into disrepair, and Belk finally discontinued the displays in the mid-1980s when the corporate office began sending its own representatives to decorate the windows. The figures went into storage until 1995 when the store closed and the Christmas displays were sold at auction. Former Thomasville Mayor Hubert Leonard couldn't stand to see the beloved characters tossed aside, so he bought a dozen of them and stored them in his attic, which, in hindsight, was probably not the best place for their fragile clockwork. Leonard even donated the collection to the Beautification Committee, which did its best to showcase them in different buildings downtown. But nothing could bring back their former luster, and soon enough, the elves and other figures found themselves out of sight, but not, at least for Barnes, out of mind. Learning the truth about the elves was heartbreaking, but Barnes's optimism returned when she discovered the Geppetto of Brooklyn. With the unanimous approval of the board, she sent photographs of the elves and a letter to the toy maker. 5 days later, her phone rang. It was Lou Nasty himself offering to pay a house call to Thomasville's elves. In the world of Christmas displays, more specifically, displays with mechanized characters who sing and dance and build wooden toys and paint baby dolls, Nasty is the reigning king. For 50 years, the Brooklyn native has been using mechanical and electrical animation to bring all sorts of whimsical characters to life. Santas, elves, teddy bears, snowmen, carolers, nutcrackers, gingerbread men, reindeer, toys, soldiers, with a thick walrus life mustache, wire-rimmed spectacles, and a kindly face, Nasty even looks the part of Pinocchio's toy maker. "I make people happy," he says. "People are stuffy and starchy these days, and I make them happy." Nasty began building robots and other mechanical creatures when he was just a teenager, one making the front page of the New York Times for a robot he built named Mr. Obos. Before long, he was helping create Christmas window displays for New York department stores, including Santa Land at Macy's. In 1969, he opened his own company, Mechanical Displays Incorporated, and began building his own designs. Back in those days, if you had a doll in the window that could turn its head, people were amazed, Nasty recalls. We have synchronized figures that talk and sing and dance. We've come a long way. Nasty worked out of a 15,000-square-foot warehouse in Brooklyn next to a body shop. It's nothing to look at from the outside, but it's an enchanting world on its own making. In April, he flew down to Thomasville for a first-hand look at the Alps to see if he could fix them. Barnes was thrilled to meet him and inspired by his artistry. He'll tell you he never worked a day in his life, Barnes says, because he loves what he does so much. With Barnes and other committee members gathered round, he examined the dusty, lifeless creations with deep interest. Then he stopped and pointed to two of the elves. "Those two are mine," he said, leaning in for a closer look. "I don't ever build a mechanical with a motor inside because they're too hard to maintain. My motors are always beneath the characters, just like these two." He nodded to Barnes. "They're definitely mine." Reunited with his old work, Nasty took to the project with gusto. He admits that he got a little carried away. Over a period of about 6 months, the Toymaker and his team created 20 new characters to join the 6 original elves and 6 other figures that he restored. Each piece traveled through the various departments, casting, molding, animation, costuming, scenery, until they were ready for shipping. "It's completely built and put together here in my shop," Nasty says. "I have a think chair where I sit and just stare at the scene, and eventually I'll see what it needs, what prop I need, or how I want to dress this elf. Then I draw it, and we make it. Every day for weeks, he'll keep coming back with new drawings. They say I'm never really finished till the truck pulls up," he says with a chuckle. When the truck reached Thomasville in September, Barnes, who had only seen photos of the Toymaker's work in progress, was stunned. "The craftsmanship, the work, it's like nothing I've ever seen," she says. In November, Nasty returned to Thomasville to install his creations in 3 large windows on the old Belk property, which today is occupied by the Thomasville Emporium. The experience he created is a fitting coda to the elves' story. On the outside of the building, a small chalet houses an animated talking and singing Pinocchio, voiced by Nasty, who greets visitors with an introduction to the display and a welcome to Thomasville. The 3 windows tell the story of Santa and his elves preparing for Christmas. In the first window on East Main Street, elves work feverishly to finish making their toys, drilling, hammering, sawing, and sanding. Around the corner, on the Commerce Street side of the building, the second window features elves putting the finishing touches on the toys. A little farther down, the 3rd window shows the North Pole's packing and shipping department, where a working conveyor belt readies the toys for Christmas Eve. Barnes marvels. "I've never seen anything like it, and I don't think anyone else in North Carolina has either." The project cost the beautification committee $50,000, but that was paid through grants and donations solicited by the committee. Many of the donations came from former Thomasville residents who still remember fondly the old Belk windows. "Every step of the way," Barnes says, "things somehow fell into place. It was sheer happenstance finding Lou Nasty. I didn't think we'd find anybody who could do what he's done," she says. "Really, it's a Christmas miracle." Jimmy Tomlin was the person who wrote that. The Thomasville Emporium is at 12 Commerce Street in Thomasville, and the Christmas display began on November 23rd. It's got a while to go, but I don't know what the end date is. I am sorry about that. And now, to wrap up, we will go to the front of the book and read one of the short articles up here. This one's under "We Live Here, Shopkeep, Hickory, A Clean Start." A near-fatal accident led Katie Fredieu, not sure whether to pronounce it like the French or not, F-R-E-D-I-E-U, Fredieu, maybe, Fredieu, anyway, to soap-making to care for her wounds and her community. With their creamy colors and flavors like black raspberry vanilla and sweet orange chili pepper, the products at Hickory-based Artisan Soapery seem good enough to eat. Not surprisingly, since owner Katie Fredieu ran a successful cake decorating business in her hometown of Las Vegas for years. After a near-fatal motorcycle accident in 2011, though, she was forced to give up that profession. When she struggled with skin irritation around her scars, she started making her own soap with organic ingredients. Within a week, my rashes were gone, she says. I thought, there's got to be other people with skin ailments who I could help, too. Freddie's success led to her own brick-and-mortar business in California. Since moving to North Carolina with her husband in 2017, she's been selling soaps, bath bombs, and other products out of a renovated 1926 storefront on Hickory's Union Square. In the back, she blends 9 organic emollients, as well as milk from her own goats, to craft soaps in a wide range of colors and scents. Some, like the Blue Ridge Mountains and Rolling Foothills bar soaps, honor her new home state by reflecting the nearby landscape. Freddie often hosts Mum's Nights Out, as well as groups of homeschoolers who learn about chemistry through her soap-making demonstrations. And every Saturday, she invites other artisans to hold pop-ups inside the store, selling everything from pottery to chocolates. I love contributing to this amazing community, says Freddie, who now serves on Hickory's downtown board. North Carolina has been so good to me. Written by C.A. Carlson. Artisan Soapery is at 234 Union Square in Hickory. They have a website, artisansoapery.com. And there's a photo here. It says, in addition to handmade bar soap, Katie creates beard balms, a full skincare line, bath bombs, and an all-natural bug repellent. Couple of advertisements here as we bring on the music to march us on out for this Christmas Eve recording. Windsor Jewelers is on Stratford Road in Winston-Salem and Phillips Place in Charlotte. And they would like you to come see their classic and innovative designer jewelry and Swiss timepieces to wrap up the holidays. And then we see preserving the dark skies for future generations. And two of these three pictures are quite dark. One is way up there, and another one is somebody looking through the side of a telescope into a starlit sky behind. And then there's a picture of somebody doing the same thing during the day, and we can see a blue sky. Listed in the top 23 best stargazing sites in the world by CNN, the Bear Dark Sky Observatory is an international dark sky certified site. The observatory, located in the Mayland Earth to Sky Park in Burnsville, North Carolina, houses the largest public telescope in North Carolina and is open year-round. Experience the dark sky as you have never seen it before. For information on how to visit and make reservations, visit mayland.edu/observatory. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.